one of the biggest shocks in World Cup history and the game that brought El Hadji Diouf to England. This is Le Classique, and we are revisiting France-Senegal from the 2002 World Cup. So hi everyone, this is your host Tom from Le Classique. I'm joined as always with Baptiste. How are you doing, Baptiste? Did you enjoy watching this game?
Yes, I'd actually never watched it before now. And so I was excited, full of trepidation. And yeah, that was fun. That was fun watching it actually. Obviously, the pain isn't the same as it was back then, but it was fun seeing those players strut their stuff.
Yeah, so this is part of something that we wanted to do when we started Le Classique was really to go sort of dive into the archive a little bit and maybe watch some classic games that we had sort of heard of but that we had missed for whatever reasons. Maybe we were too young at the time, or I think this was of course the World Cup in South Korea and Japan in 2002, where time differences made it difficult for us watching these games. Obviously, we were at school. Sometimes you could get people would smuggle in illegal TVs, an era of portable TVs, or sometimes they would be nice and kind of show it at the city, at the library. Yeah. But I think we both actually missed this game in person.
Yeah.
And so I think like you, this was my first time viewing this match. I mean, obviously we've done one game before, which was to look at France-Bulgaria, which I think you described as arguably the most traumatic game in France's history. Is this a close second?
Yeah, it's very close. I mean, yeah, we did France-Bulgaria. I think special mention for France-West Germany in 1982 at Seville, which is the only game, I think, in France, if you say the location of the game, like, you know, for a France game in Seville, people were like, okay, it's 1982, like, you know, it's not the same for the Bulgaria game and this game, but certainly in terms of the shock and the impact it had on French football, it was a traumatic episode. I think it's obviously been less it's had less of an impact than 82. I think I would still rank that as the top one, simply because there had been no French success before 1982, and everybody loved that team, and Patrick Battiston getting clattered by Harold Schumacher. There was a real sense of unfairness. You know, Bulgaria 93 was just a huge shock of how did we lose at home to the Bulgarians, with all due respect, and how are we missing a World Cup, you know, yet again. This one is totally different because of different set of expectations and a different relationship to that team as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we obviously we're Le Classique and we focus on France and French football, but I think what I also like about this game is I think it really marks the emergence of Senegal, at least in the global kind of football consciousness, you know, into the kind of, you know, the real power of African football that it is today. And I think this is, you know, even when you look at the recent success Senegal has had, it very, very much feels influenced by this team that we're going to talk about here. So, you know, their coach, Aliou Cissé, is their captain in this particular
game.
And I also, this is, I think, one of the most, I don't know, iconic celebrations in World Cup history. It's going a little bit because there's so many other great ones, you know, the Bibito one. But I think the Bouba Diop goal and the dancing around the corner flag, I think, is one of the most iconic World Cup celebrations. Also, it's one of the great images, and this era now of when the holders used to play the first game rather than the hosts, I think, into some interesting shocks. And this, I think, is probably certainly one of the biggest shocks of opening games in World Cup history, and probably one of the actually biggest shocks in World Cup history. You know, point final.
Yeah, 100%. And to add to that, I think is also, and we're going to talk about it a little bit, but it's the fact that this is such a French side to beat France in a way, right? That the close, you know, for some sad reasons, but hopefully some more positive reasons in more recent times, I would hope. But the close cultural links between the two countries, and the fact that many of those players, not all of them, played in France, I think added a little flavor to it as well. And I think also kind of, I remember at the time when France lost, people reacted with anger at the France squad, if I can put it that way, but didn't begrudge the Senegalese their victory. There wasn't this tension, and maybe I'm seeing it in an idealistic way because I was, you know, I was small and I wasn't necessarily aware of everything that was going on in the world. But, you know, when you look at France, Morocco at the last World Cup, there was a lot of talk built up by obviously a racist part of France and then a very xenophobic media about people who are French and of Moroccan origin. You know, how are they going to celebrate? Who are they going to root for? If Morocco wins, are we going to see, you know, people of Moroccan descent and origins, you know, go out in the street and celebrate? And should we be insulted by that? Blah, 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 blah. And all this really negative, toxic debate. I don't remember any of that for... there might have been some. I'm not saying there wasn't. But yeah. I don't remember any of that for France, Senegal 2002. It was more kind of like, well played, plucky neighbors. You know, kind of, you know, our mates from down the street. Well played for being us and teaching us a lesson.
So doing some research, obviously, for this, I think, because Senegal come into this, I think, sort of hugely underestimated. No? So beforehand, I think Play makes a famous prediction and kind of calls them the weakest team in the group. And it is a strong group, right? France is in there with Uruguay, with Denmark, and with Senegal. But apparently, Bruno Mitsu, the coach of Senegal, uses this as inspiration. But actually, you know, this is a team, as you say, that's full of, you know, quite strong Ligue 1 players. That's what I quite like about it. And when you go through the teams they play for, it's just like classic Ligue 1 teams, you know, from Sochaux, Lens, Lille. It's just a perfect kind of mid-table, maybe European French sides. But this is a team also that had, you know, that had just lost out in the African Cup of Nations in January 2002 in penalties. So really, this was a strong African side already, and I think was probably underestimated going into this World Cup. And ultimately, they used this for motivation to their advantage, and I think surprised a lot of people at the World Cup in wonderful ways.
Absolutely, they were not the most recognizable African nation at a World Cup, right? They had never been at the World Cup before. They were kind of the sleeping giants of African football. I mean, all those names in that squad were very recognizable for French fans for good reason. Those were good players playing for good teams in France in different positions, different styles. But there had always been that sense of Senegal doesn't deliver an international tournament. It's fleeting, you know, in a way similar to a country like Algeria, right? It's, again, close links with France. Lots of those players play in France, and they grace the pitch with talent, and yet we're not seeing that on the international stage. But with Bruno Metsu and a generation of players that really clicked with him, and that just believed in themselves, you can see that in the game, and we'll go on about it. They, you know, they announced their return on the African stage of the African Cup of Nations in 2002 to the final. And at the World Cup, they, you know, they gave it a real go. And you know, other African teams at the World Cup, I'm thinking in particular about Cameroon, I think, were at that World Cup. But, you know, it feels like they were non-stories at the 2002 World Cup. And these guys, they came in, they believed in themselves. I think the fact that they played France obviously was a huge motivation for them, and who knows how their tournament would have gone if they hadn't achieved a positive result. That's an obvious thing to say, but it led them into this beautiful dynamic for the rest of the tournament that wasn't stopped by a poor result against France, and you know, fate could have been otherwise.
And if Senegal were sort of underestimated in the build up to this game, I think France was the total opposite. And so I think they were the favourites with the bookies. I think with Argentina also at the time, obviously France are world and European champions. They have the top goal scorers from the English league in Thierry Henry, the Italian league in Trezeguet, the French league in Djibril Cissé. Mm. You know, Zidane is still arguably the best player in the world. And I remember there's this air of almost overconfidence, though, that you feel with France at the time. And famously, I think, was it an Adidas ad?
Yes.
I remember which brand it was promoting. I think it was Adidas, where you've got the shirt already with two stars. And I think of, you know, the France team was so, to a certain degree, oversaturated, you know, with sponsors. Mm. They were on the TV all the time. You couldn't go to Carrefour without seeing some kind of product that was sponsoring the French national team. And there is, I think, is it fair to say, an air of overconfidence from the French side going into this tournament? Although maybe that's hindsight speaking. I mean, what was your view of how it was viewed at the time?
The Adidas advert with a second star made a lot of people react with a bit of concern. I think I remember that advert at the time, and I remember thinking, yes, we're one of the favorites and we should be confident. Frankly speaking, that group is not, this is not the group of death. This is not the scariest group, but that's a hell of a statement to make before a World Cup. And also we've only won one, right? I mean, it's just real recency bias. Now, with hindsight, that's obviously hubris and that's arrogance. But if we take a quick look back, I mean, from 98 to 2002, and certainly in just before 2002, at the Euro 2000, France is by far the best side in the world. I mean, 98, you would argue it's built off a really solid defensive base and you know, and players who start believing themselves, unbelievable organization, and some lucky knocks along the way. You know, if it goes to penalty against Paraguay with Chilavert in that form, who knows? Roberto Baggio misses by an inch, you know, against us, and we beat them on penalties in the quarters. It's the Lino Turam game in the semis, and Ronaldo has an epileptic seizure in the final. I mean, there are. If you redo this World Cup campaign 20 times, there's at least half of them where we go out, you know, in the earlier stages. But in 2000, for me personally, it's going to sound weird to say that because of the 2006 World Cup and that incredibly famous game against Brazil, which I still watch the highlights of on a semi-regular basis from Zidane. But for me, Euro 2000 in a France shirt is Zidane's pinnacle. And that side is unstoppable. And if you look at Euro 2000, the performances there, France beats some of the favorites. We beat Spain. We outplay them. And we righted our luck against Italy, but that's a great Italy side. And we beat them through our hearts. So by the time 2001 and early 2002, comes into sight, you know, France has the best strikers in the world. France has Zinedine Zidane. It also has Robert Pires, who's very sadly missed here. But just before he gets injured towards the end of the 2001-2002 season, that's the picture. And on top of that, you have that defensive base that remains similar to sort of Arsenal under Wenger, basically. I think that's the evolution of France over a four-year period is... It starts off as kind of George Graham's Arsenal in 96, 98, and it evolves into this beautiful side that's led by really charismatic attacking players whilst retaining that mm-hmm, speed. Mm-hmm. So by the time you arrive in 2002, it is gross overconfidence to have that second star on as an advert. But if you had asked 100 analysts and pundits who followed football at that time, I'm not saying 100 would have said France are going to win it, but we were the overwhelming favorites, basically. So it was overconfidence, but it was well-deserved confidence at the time.
Yeah. And so France, obviously, so I totally forgotten actually about the Pires injury, which was a big kind of build, because this, of course, you know, given that Zidane also gets a knock, this could have been his great opportunity to pull the strings. And so the French team that kind of lines up against Senegal includes, as you say, lots of the winners from 98-2000s. Barthez is in goal. Thuram Lizarazu with the fullbacks. Leboeuf de Seille at the back. Petit, Vieira, Henri on the left, Viltord on the right. And then it's Djorkaeff that's chosen to play behind Trezeguet to kind of take the Zidane mantle, if you were. Do you want to talk us a little bit about the kind of the Zidane build up to 2002? Because there's always a kind of spiritual fervor when it comes to how the French consider Zinedine.
I mean, by 2002, Zidane is an icon, right? I mean, he's scored both two goals in the World Cup final. He was the best player at the Euro 2000. He was the best player in the world. He's 2001, 2002. That might be in the 2002 Champions League final, he scores what perhaps remains the greatest goal ever scored in the Champions League final. Although Gareth Bale gave him a really good run for that money. But so, you know, at that stage, he's 30. He's iconic. He's, you know, he's also iconic just in everything about him. You know, he's what he represents for France with his origins, with his dignity, you know, the bald head, you know, all the many shots that you'd see in a game of just the sweat pouring down his face, and he'd just glide through little moments of magic, and he'd deliver in the big games. He's a walking icon, and yet, because of a long season and because France travels sort of at the last minute and has an half-ass game against South Korea because they're the hosts, and we're a bit of a traveling circus, you know, he gets injured. I think he pulls his hamstring in the last game 5 days before the start of the World Cup. So I'm not going to say it's sort of everyone at battle stations and panic across the board when he gets injured. The thinking process at that moment in time is, who's going to step up in his absence in the system? And how long is his injury for? Can he come back, maybe play the last game of the group stage and build up his fitness for the inevitable knockout stage that we will reach, because that group is not the strongest group at the World Cup? So that's the thinking. And it doesn't surprise me that Djorkaeff is given the mantle. He's 34 at that moment in time, and much like Dugarry, who later come on, and a few of those players maybe, you know, he benefits from having all that past history with France. He was still one of my favorite players, a wonderfully talented player, but it's slightly different style, maybe more dynamic with the ball at his feet than Zidane, less of an organizer. But because of his past service and the fact he still has qualities, he's given that task. And we'll see in that game it doesn't work out. Then it goes to Miku in one of the follow-up games. And Zidane comes back in the last game, I think, but he's obviously not the same player. Yeah. He's just coming back from injury. But because of the result of this game, there's this anxiety that builds. And now it's, we've lost this game because Zidane wasn't there, and look how poor France are when Zidane doesn't play, when actually I think it's a lot more nuanced than that when you watch the game.
Yeah, so Senegal line up in a sort of defensive system, but that's designed to counter-attack on France. They play kind of a 4-5-1, especially with really a muscular centre mid. So you've got Boubadi up in there, Aliou Cissé and Salif Diao, who are all fairly defensive-minded central midfielders. Fadiga's on the left, Ndiaye on the right, and then Diouf is the sole striker. And I think this is really the game that, as we suggested in the intro, you know, where a lot of the world will discover El Hadji Diouf and will convince Liverpool to spend £11 million on him, which is not an inconsiderable amount at the time. And then, again, the back four, so these guys, I think, all play in France, right? So Silva, Koli, Diata, Malik Diop, and Omar Daff. So it teams like, I think, Monaco, Lens, social. So it really is a kind of, it's got, as you say, such a French flavor in the sense that lots of these guys play in France, and of course will be francophone also, right?
Speaking
on the pitch to one another and to their opponents.
And 21 of their 23 players in their squad play in France at that moment in time. Yeah. The only two who don't are the sub goalkeepers. So, close links with France. Many players play for the same club. There's a strong loss contingent in there, and they line up in a system that Roger Lemaire readily admitted after the game and said that 4-5-1 with, you know, that strong disciplined midfield that you've mentioned, still able to burst through, particularly Bouba Diop, who goes, you know, for the goal and able to project themselves forward very rapidly in support of Diop. You know, he said that we really struggled to break that down, and Bruno Metsu with the magic tactics.
Yeah. So if we describe it sort of briefly, what the kind of key highlights, because whilst it isn't a classic, I think, in the sense of being an exciting game, actually quite a lot does happen. So in the first half, I think Senegal are quite strong and surprising, and I think they're dangerous on the counter. I think Diouf has a fantastic first half. He'll be named man of the match, which is maybe based on his key contributions in that first half rather than the second. But there's an early threat where I think he skins Dussey down the right, pulls it back to Fadiga, who has a shot that's saved by Barthez. And then in around the 22nd minute, he does the same thing down the left with Leboeuf, who I think has quite a difficult game, it's fair to say.
Yes.
He pulls it back to Bouba Diop, who's made a good run. And I think there's a lucky kind of bounce to a certain extent, and then the ball falls back to him and he puts it into an empty net.
Yeah, but it's a complete replica of the action at the start that you've mentioned. You know, it's the action on the right-hand side. I think it's in the fifth or sixth minute. And you've just invites Dussey to tackle him, you know, just by letting the ball glide sort of past him before taking it past Dussey and then looking for the cutback. He does exactly the same to Leboeuf, who foolishly, I mean, I say that for Leboeuf, but same for Dussey. And actually, it's quite a repetitive pattern in the game of just foolish attempts at interceptions from many, many players, but, you know, throws himself to try and get the ball, misses the tackle, Diouf pulls it back. Emmanuel Petit actually tracks Bouba Diop really well because he intercepts the ball. But his interception, you know, I'm not going to say a moment of panic, but he tries to clear it. Barthez had tried to come for the interception. It hits Barthez, rolls back towards Bouba Diop, who has, you know, presence of mind, all, you know, very quick presence of mind to, you know, get his foot through it and score. So, you know, defensive mishaps, but also, you know, a certain stroke of luck, frankly, for Senegal. And that's after France had hit the post, you know, a few minutes earlier through Trezeguet. And actually, I have to say, in the first sort of 8-10 minutes, Senegal really are on the front foot. And what I did find impressive when watching the game was the fact that they were clearly the underdogs, but there was a real desire at the start of the game to take the game onto France, which, again, when you put it in the context, is really impressive to have that confidence of saying, first World Cup for us, playing the world champions, the clear, overwhelming favorites, and we're going to look at them in the eye and not back down straight away. It becomes more and more difficult as the half progresses. You can tell there is quality in the France squad, and when it accelerates, there's little moments, but, you know, the goal breaks that down and puts Senegal in the ascendancy.
Overall, I was sort of, on the whole, surprised with the lack of tempo, but I suppose it is international football, and as you say, there are little moments where you can see France start to accelerate. I think they dominate the second half but lack creativity. I think the Senegalese block drops even deeper. Obviously, they hit the post through Thierry Henry in that second half, who does a classic Henry, you know, sort of curling it in from the left, but just clips the bar. But then Fadiga also hits the bar himself on a counter. So still, Senegal continue to threaten. I think France are a little bit lethargic and lack urgency, I think it's fair to say. And I think Senegal do deserve their victory in the end. One thing that I was interested about this game is there's this kind of dual view of this World Cup from France, which on one hand, they totally underperformed and flopped. But on the other, it's a World Cup. I think they hit the bar six times in three games or something like this. So I was keen to revisit to see, actually, were they just really unlucky in this group stage? But actually, from my viewing of this game, I think Senegal do deserve their victory. And I think possibly the fact that it's the first game for France, they probably still think, like Argentina did at this World Cup, that okay, it's not a good start, but we can still get out of this. We're still the world and European champions.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't end their chances straight away, that defeat. It's the hubris that start that precedes it and that follows it, frankly, that allows for that. And as you said, there is a strand of slightly revisionist history of, well, yeah, we hit the post, six or seven times in three games, and desperately unlucky, and if things go our way, that is revisionist, I think. What I would say is, when I watched the game, which, as I said, was the first time, because of how traumatic that defeat was at that moment, and just how utterly shocking it was, I did expect that performance to be so discombobulated that it was just, a horrendous sight. It wasn't. And I also expected Senegal to be more on the front foot, or, not saying going to pass it around France, etc., but to have more chances. And it was a case of a glorious performance by Senegal and one of the worst performances ever by a France squad at a World Cup. I think it's a lot more nuanced than that when you watch the game. For me, it's like you said, it's a lethargic performance from France. It's a confident performance from France because you see no sense of panic, but you see no sense of urgency either from those players, and it lacks the creativity and the real desire to take people on. What I would say about Senegal is it's a performance that's undeniably and impressively full of discipline and full of heart, because you see some of the running and the tracking from Ndiaye on the right-hand side supporting Colly. I mean, Diouf never stops running. Everybody, puts their every limb out there to block every shot, etc. Not that it ever gets that desperate, but everybody's there, right? In a way, if you take away the context and you just look at the game really cold, a draw would have probably been a fair result, is the way I would look at it. But it obviously ends up being a Senegalese winner, deserved one, but it's, I feel like both sides have been slightly magnified because of the context of the result, and which is an impressive achievement from Senegal. I'm not discounting that at all. But having not had the chance to watch the game before, I was struck by how kind of neutral and first game at a World Cup feel it is.
I kind of see that, but then with an extraordinary result at the kind of end of it, because I know that you're a basketball fan and you like this Bill Simmons show where he revisits some of old games. So we thought maybe we would replicate that a little bit in terms
The
of
Podfather, as he's called.
things that have aged well and not so well from that particular game. I think one thing that stood out to me is actually how modern both goalkeepers felt. So I think for Barthez, maybe that wasn't so surprising because I knew him quite well, but was just his launching of quick counters, with his throws. So the minute he gets the ball in his hands, bam, he's looking to release one of his fullbacks or even one of his wingers with a quick throw. And actually, Silva, the Senegalese goalkeeper, in the first half, he's really high on his line at important moments, actually, where maybe one of the French players might be running through. And I think he has a terrific game, to be fair for him. Getting, catching crosses, not punching. But my general sense is, oh, these are really, modern goalkeepers in the way that we're talking about at the moment. The year that Andre Onana has joined Man United, Yeah, where Arsenal have just invested in David Raya. I thought that actually these guys felt really modern to me.
Keeping in mind that for a certain amount of time, Tony Silva was Fabian Barthez's deputy at Monaco. So right. Again, kind of, they've crossed paths, obviously. And I imagine Barthez did have an influence. You know, if you're training every day with a person who plays like that, behaves like that, that would rub off on you. I mean, Barthez, we knew when he was playing that he was maybe too modern. I mean, loved the ball at his feet.
Yeah.
You know, try to play out of defense, not a la Pascal Olmeta, but, you know, was very confident with the ball at his feet. And you see that here, not only does he play a high line, does he play in a way at Lamanuel Neuer, but he looks for the pass, you know, like with Tony Silva, he plays a high line, but you can tell he's still uncomfortable with the ball at his feet.
He's sweeping, it's true.
Yeah, he's sweeping, but he's sweeping to clear.
Whilst
Barthez, he will look for a pass here and there. Obviously, there are a few times where he just leathers it, but I was surprised, and actually, I was surprised at how high a line France played. I mean, I know El Hadji Diouf is constantly offside, it seems, for the second half, but you know, that's because they play such a high line. And actually, at the start, certainly in the first half, Senegal also do play a high line. So a lot more risk-taking there defensively than at the time. And in that sense, it was you know, quite modern. I suppose if we're looking at things that haven't aged well, I think the fullbacks and their integration into the setup is, you know, they're not here. They're here to cover. I mean, and they're here to be there defensively. They're not necessarily here to bring additional numbers up top. And I was struck by that, less so for Senegal, because, you know, Ferdinand Colley had to face Henry.
Yeah.
You know, not an easy job for Daf at, you know, at left back for against Philippe Todd. But I was surprised at that for France, especially from Lizarazu, because I remember him even in 98. And certainly in 2000, being quite an attacking fullback and being allowed to be an attacking fullback. Whilst there's a time where Desailly brings the ball out of defense, and the deepest player for France is Lizarazu. And I just thought that's really surprising. Mm-hmm. And for Thuram, I mean, we knew he was a better center back, although he was glorious in 98 and 2000. But just the, you know, he'll gallop a few times down the right and he's not going to look up. He just punts the ball up into the box. It's that tactical acumen and that use of fullbacks, which really didn't age well when you watch the game.
Yeah. But it's interesting, we were talking about this a little bit before starting recording, but also how some of these trends almost go cyclically, you know? So, having Thuram at right back, you know, if we watch that even a year ago, it seems prehistoric. But then Man City have just won with, you know, Stones playing at right back, Akanji playing at left back, you know, playing really centre halves as the fullbacks. And of course, then they're integrated into the attacking play and in the build-up in much more sophisticated ways. But it's interesting the way that position sort of trends come and go, right? And we were also talking a little bit about Trezeguet, you know, kind of striker who really doesn't get involved in the game, few touches, but clinical when he gets it. That, a couple of years ago, seemed like it was going... you know, becoming extinct almost, but I think Haaland has definitely brought that kind of style back. You know, low number of touches, but clinical when you do get it.
And it's funny because Trezeguet, you know, at the time, and you see that, to be fair to him, like as soon as he sniffs out an attempt in the first half, he hits the post. Like that's just, he's there. He's sharp, and it's funny because his time for the France squad was, we all know the Givash story in 98. Trezeguet did quite well at the World Cup, actually. We all know what he did in 2000, although he doesn't necessarily start all games, right? But by the time this sort of 2002, it's Trezeguet is the final answer at number nine for France. We've been dying for a number nine.
Mm-hmm.
We need somebody who's just going to weigh in the box and be there and be a bit of a predator. And we've been missing that. You know, and you watched the game, and you know, Diatta and Pape Malick Diop do a good job, obviously, defensively on him. But he's not fed a lot of balls, to be fair, you know, at his feet. And like you said, that cost him towards the end of his time with the France squad. It was, he doesn't bring enough to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like you said, the trend with somebody like Haaland is it doesn't matter because the ball will find its way and he will be there to finish it. So it's an interesting, it's interesting to see that even for him in his French career, he went through ups and downs of his style is exactly what we need to. His style is actually a hindrance to the France team.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that the coaching of Roger Lemaire doesn't seem particularly inspired, at least in kind of offensive patterns. And to be fair, you know, it's international football. It can be difficult to create these things. But I suppose another key thing that's maybe more important in international football is how you react to situations in games with your substitutes, etc. And I thought there he should have displays quite a lack of imagination. Obviously, we talked beforehand about how France had, you know, three of the best strikers in Europe at the time. But two of them are sort of, you know, placed on the wing, basically. So Henri, obviously, on the left, and that's fair. He's played there a lot for France. Vidal is on the right wing. Then Cissé, when he comes on, is put on the right wing. I don't know. It seems like a slight lack of imagination to try to just whack these players in and hope that a goal comes from it, rather than really any kind of plan.
Yeah, there's a plan A, there's no plan B. I mean, the fact that he himself says after the game the 4-5-1 system devised by Bruno Metsu is just blocks his team. Okay, well that's nice. That's a nice thing to say, but what you're meant to be finding a way through that's, you know, that's part of your job. Appreciating is easier said than done. I was surprised. Well, this is with a hindsight of 21 years later, but I was surprised, and I think that's partially what became his downfall as well. But when he subs off Djorkaeff, who has not had a good game, as much as I love him, he brings on Dugarry, who is not having the best of time at club level.
I was surprised to see him in the squad actually and coming on. So that was a blast from the past for sure.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's Christophe Dugarry heading towards the end of his time at Bordeaux, right? I mean, he'll be heading to Birmingham in 6 months' time, effectively, with all due respect to Birmingham. So he's for the France squad, that type of level, he's on a downward trajectory. And yet Johan Miku's sitting on the bench.
Yeah. And I know you love Miku,
but you know, he's a pure 10. So either you're going to try and break through the middle because that midfield three might tire, maybe different type of movement with Miku, different type of distribution, or you allow, you know, in my mind, you allow your fullbacks to push up, and Nizar is certainly capable of that, and yet none of that really happens. It's just very stale. So it's not just the choice of personnel to make the change. It's there's no tactical movement. And then when he brings on Cissé, it's very much all of a sudden you look at the team and Cissé is on the right wing where he never plays for his club. Henri's back up top now with Trezeguet. Dugarry is in a sort of half attacking mid, half left winger role. He actually does combine relatively well with Lizarazu, but there's not a lot of creativity in trying to find a solution to a glaring problem. And actually the fact that Bruno Metsu makes zero changes throughout the game, I think says it all. He's very comfortable. He trusts his players, doesn't see anything thrown at them that's going to unravel them. And I think that hasn't aged well for Roger Lemaire.
One thing we discussed on the previous game that we looked at, which was obviously the early 90s, right? So it was a very different kind of fashion. We called the Chris Waddle Award, which is kind of fashion from the time. Obviously, this, in some ways, this looks, I think, quite a lot like modern football stylistically in terms of what the players look like, their choices of haircut. But does anything stand up to you in terms of what the players were looked like or were wearing?
Just the appearance of jewelry, just across, you know, Papa Bubba Diop, Tony Silva, they have sort of their, would you call it chains? But, you know, the, you know, even with a like little, you know, Catholic cross or whatever, or, you know, and I think El Hadji Diouf has an earring. I think one of those players has an earring. So, yeah, quite surprising. I thought that had stopped a long time ago. So it was quite funny to see that. It felt very sort of early 2000s kind of baggy style, you know, kind of overflowy shirt, you know, just not very fitting. Whilst now it's, you know, it's kind of like very tight, very, you know, shows off the muscles kind of kit. So yeah, old school kits and some bejeweled accessories. I was quite surprised by that.
Yeah, the jewelry was good. What also stood out to me was I liked it when Diouf and Cissé were both on the pitch, you know, with their kind of gone peroxide hair, almost on opposite sides. But I thought that was always a great thing with Cissé. You know, you could always count on him, to be fair, for a good fashion statement.
Yeah.
Even today, I think he's a man with a passion for fashion.
Yeah.
Should we talk about, I guess, the aftermath of this game? So obviously, Senegal win, great scenes, great celebrations, but they won't stop there. They'll qualify from the group. They'll reach the quarters, I think.
Or yeah,
the
quarterfinals, yeah.
They get knocked out by Turkey.
Yeah, after extra time.
Maybe actually the Senegalese story is the great story. So maybe let's start a little bit about the aftermath of, maybe let's not talk about this game, but France's World Cup 2002. So they'll then draw against Uruguay and lose to Denmark, and they'll be out of the World Cup. But how is this viewed? What's the aftermath of this debacle for France?
Well, it is a debacle, right? I mean, the second start might have been overconfident, but no one expected to go out in the group stages in a pretty weak group, with all due respect to the three sides. So the reaction is immediate. I mean, Roger Lemaire is sacked. Jacques Santini, who's just won the title with Lyon, is brought in. I think Franck Leboeuf, I think, announces his international retirement. Should have maybe announced it right after the Senegal game. But it's, you know, it's a humbling for France. I think it's the humbling, and it's the start of what we would call the désamour with the France squad, right? So there are various phases with Les Bleus, I think, that have taken place in my lifetime. I feel one, which is, you know, I would call 94 to 98 the sort of period where there is no faith in the France squad. We have no confidence. Anything can happen. We won't be disappointed. We won't be exultant because we don't expect anything. Especially with the Jacquet way of playing, you know, it's solid. It's not the most inspiring. It's not going to get, you know, bums on seats, basically. That's the way to look at it. 98 happens. We've mentioned it. You know, unbelievable event. Culturally significant with the Black Blanc Beur generation. Zidane's face plastered on the Arc de Triomphe means a lot to a lot of people, understandably so, and for good reason. But from 98, well, in 98, it's still a surprise. In 2000, France dominates world football at the Euros. I know it doesn't include the rest, doesn't include the rest of world football, but if you don't come out of Euro 2000 thinking France is the best squad in the world, then you haven't watched football, I think. And so, therefore, once you get to 2002, it's the expectation. Like you said, everyone's really popular, all those players. We walk in there with a happy feeling. It all comes crashing down. And now it's defiance and le désamour over these players. Mm-hmm. And France loves nothing more than hating its fallen giants, right? And it becomes sort of a 10 to 12-year period of decline. And I know the 2006 World Cup final happens, but actually in 2006... If we had lost in the group stages, people would have just been like, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. It's finally the end for those oldies, right? And by the time 2010 happens and with Knysna in the bus, you know, we're talking parliamentary committees now, right?
And
that's not even a populist move, you know, or at least it's the easiest populist move ever by French parliamentarians. So it does take from 2002, I think, to 2014 for people to actually like Les Bleus again. And that's
it's
because it's the decline of that generation, and it's the flip side to their success. They brought so much joy to people that, you know, with their success and then their decline, and the decline didn't age gracefully. They, you know, some players stayed in the squad based on past performances, and I extend that to the likes of Thierry Henry in 2010, right? So it's the start of a phase that took a lot of time getting out of, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because even at periods where France were on paper at least quite successful, right, reaching the final of the 2006 World Cup, it's true that you never, you know, if you were living in France, somehow the affinity certainly wasn't there to the same degree as previous teams that had gone as far. So even though the results were not disastrous during that time, or that there were a couple of debacles, but there were also some high points in terms of results, somehow, you still felt that the connection wasn't really there with the side. I mean, in contrast, the Senegal team become icons and heroes in their home countries. I think a national holiday gets announced, I think actually maybe after this victory.
stick it to the man, I think.
Not even waiting for their great performance.
Yeah, screw you, France.
It's what kind
fair
of
play, thing. Total fair play.
Triggered it. But I think it's fair to say that so many of these players are now icons in their home country. I think an obvious one is Aliou Cissé, right, who will become the coach of Senegal, lead them to their first ever African Cup of Nations, won, of course, on penalties after a 0-0 final, which is the standard way to win La Coupe d'Afrique des Nations. But even someone like El Hadji Diouf, right, who I think within the UK now has kind of a pantomime villain image, but in, I think, Senegal is very much a kind of celebrated legend in the way that maybe, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an analogy, maybe a kind of Cristiano Ronaldo in Portugal kind of vibe. It's almost because he doesn't hide away from his flashiness, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I think I recall reading an interview or some comments by him where he said something along those lines. He said something like, you know, when I go back to Senegal, everybody loves me because I'm the Cristiano Ronaldo of Senegal, like, I think, or some other, you know, incredible icon. And it's obviously very funny. It's very easy to laugh at that because the image he gave, you know, which was deplorable, frankly, for in England. I mean, we all remember his attitude, spitting on a Celtic fan, you know, and frankly, not producing a lot of great football whilst he was there. But he's a player, and much like all his teammates, who became sublime for his national team, and who never betrayed his national team. When he would step onto that pitch, he'd give it everything he'd get. And probably disappointingly for his club managers, that, you know, they'd be watching him play for Senegal and be like, where has this guy been all year, right? But if you support your country and you see a player who clearly over delivers and overperforms for your national side, there's nothing you like more than that, I would believe. And I think you look at players across nations who have always given everything to play for the national sides and have become icons. You know, Drogba in Côte d'Ivoire, although Drogba also, you know, on the side stopped a civil war, which is an altogether mightily impressive feat. But, you know, the likes of Eto'o in Cameroon, right? Ronaldo for Portugal, you could argue Messi for Argentina, or that there was Maradona, you know, Zidane for France. You know, it's all relative in terms of the pure ability and the pure talent, but that's the impact that those guys have had, that generation has had on Senegal. And I imagine, you know, if you look at somebody like Ismaël Sarr, right, for Senegal, or even Sadio Mane, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure if you ask him who his first footballing hero was, would have been somebody like El Hadji Diouf, right? So that's also the impact that he's had. And he, you know, he is an icon in Senegal. And we should say all those players are. I think if Kalilou Fadiga goes back to Senegal, he'll be given a hero's welcome, and that's well deserved.
Yeah. And one man who sadly can't receive that anymore is Bruno Mitsu. And I think we just wanted to conclude with by talking about the coach of Senegal at this World Cup, because he had quite an interesting career, and I think was particularly interesting in the way that he really embraced Senegal, the country he was managing. When I looked at his career, which is quite eclectic, and he spent a lot of time in different countries, I wondered whether he was sort of the Hervé Renard of his time in a way. But what I think becomes clear is that he really committed to the country he was managing. He married a Senegalese woman,
who's now Hervé Renard's wife.
I think
I read that in L'Équipe.
Because my analogy was just based on him managing in different African countries, say, or in the Middle East a little bit. But then when you said, again, testament to your amazing football knowledge, Beppo.
the fact I have I'm subscribed to L'Équipe, and they keep coming up with these types of articles. Yeah. but yes, I mean, you know, there was for a long time, and there still remains, a very damaging stereotype in international football management with African nations. And that is that you needed to bring a white coach to bring in discipline and to fight off all the stereotypes that people for a very long time had completely unfairly about African footballers and organization there. And I think if you look at, you know, a number of managers who have only managed there that have been absolute mercenaries and have never truly cared there. You know, I can't help but think of Claude Leroy, who I think in every managerial role in Africa.
Yeah.
You know, and when it's like, oh, I'll go manage the DRC under Mobutu and then I'll go to manage Libya or whatever, you kind of go, I'm wondering what you're in there for.
Mm-hmm.
And always bringing this negative stereotypical attitude, like I've said, of I will bring in principles of football that are working in Europe, and I will bring Europe to Africa.
Mm-hmm. You know,
that's such a negative way of looking at things. Bruno Mitsu did the complete opposite of that, and that's why he was utterly adored by his players and by people in Senegal. Is he came in, he understood, he cared, he understood, he obviously met somebody he loved there, which obviously shows how much he cared, and he loved the place as well. I think because you need to have the empathy and the ability to really understand people there, to live and love a local. And he let those players be themselves. So a few of those players had been removed from the international team before for alleged poor discipline, etc. He just wiped the slate clean and just said, look, I don't care, you know, what you do when you're not under my watch, so long as when you're under my watch, you deliver. You know, I don't care if you go out the night before, or I don't care if you need to do X, Y, Z, because it's not just about, you know, indiscipline like going out. It's maybe, you know, going to see family members because you're back in the country, you know, things like that. So I don't mind about that, so long as you give me everything you've got when you're playing. And you can't help but see that when you watch the game. I mean, if you look at the tireless running of so many of these players, you know, they overperform for their country, but clearly because they've got a manager that they believe in as well and who believed in them. So, you know, Bruno Mitsu is a wonderful story, I think. for It's a Wonderful Story. You know, he sadly passed away in 2013. I think it's 2013 from cancer. You know, and he was obviously very young. He was not even 60. He basically received, national funeral in Senegal. Senegalese president spoke there. I think a few of his players were pallbearers. President of the National Assembly of Senegal was there. You know, he was his coffin was draped in the flag of Senegal, and he's interred in near Dakar. So, had a genuine impact, and I think that's what makes the Senegalese story at that World Cup so great. And I think what we wanted to focus as well, not just on, yes, it's another traumatic episode for French football, yada yada yada. You know, that's what we're interested in, and it's fun, but it's also paying tribute to somebody who understood the community he was joining and loved it.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to leave it, and I think that's why we like to research some of these older games, because there's always an angle that maybe you hadn't thought of so much before that, as you dig in, you can learn about and understand. So, again, one of the most traumatic moments in history, and one of the greatest for Senegal. So thanks, Beppo, so much. This has been Le Classique, and we've been reviewing one of our classic games, which was France 0, Senegal 1, 2002.